Good evening. I'm William Brangham. Jeff Bennett and Amna Nawaz are away. On the NewsHour tonight, efforts to curb carbon pollution turns to heavy industries like cement and steel that contribute enormously to global warming. Then, gang violence in Haiti displaces hundreds of thousands of people and traps Americans trying to flee. And a new investigation details how police tactics meant to just stop people often end up killing them.
Officers went too far, too fast, too long, and they were making errors in the way they applied this force that went beyond best safety practices.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Initial stages of a salvage operation are underway tonight at the site of the bridge collapse in Baltimore. One giant crane and a smaller one arrived today, with more coming. They will clear away the concrete and mangled metal, as well as the cargo ship that hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge. But officials warned it is a mammoth job.
It is not going to be days or weeks or months. This is going to take time. Every single phase we have to focus on safety of the people who are doing the work. We have to make sure that we're doing it in cooperation and collaboration with all the parties that are going to need to be involved inside this work. We have to make sure that we're doing it in an environmentally sound way. And we have to make sure we're focusing on completion.
Also today, the White House announced President Biden will visit Baltimore next week to view the operation. There are more signs that inflation is gradually easing. A gauge tracked by the Federal Reserve shows prices rose 0.3% in February. That's down slightly from the January rise. The year-to-year increase was still 2.5%, still above the Fed's goal of just 2%. Former senator and vice presidential candidate Joe Lieberman was laid to rest today in Stamford, Connecticut. Politicians and family remembered the longtime Democrat turned independent for his bipartisanship. They included Al Gore, the Democrats' 2000 presidential nominee, who chose Lieberman as his running mate.
I saw him ready to reclaim friendships that had been seared by disagreements, ready to look for ways to bridge divisions, ready to seek reconciliation, ready to stand for his principles, always.
Lieberman passed away Wednesday after suffering a fall. He was 82 years old. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu now says he's ready to return to mediated talks with Hamas. His office issued a statement today saying that he, quote, approved the next round of talks in the coming days in Doha and Cairo. Negotiations have appeared stalled after a series of stops and starts. Meanwhile, Israel hit Syria today with the deadliest airstrikes in years. An independent Syrian war monitoring group reports 44 people were killed, mostly Syrian troops. The attacks came mainly outside Aleppo, targeting the missile depots of Hezbollah militants who are backed by Iran. Israel has stepped up strikes inside Syria since the war in Gaza began. That war put a damper today on Good Friday observances in Jerusalem. Fewer people than usual carried crosses through the streets of the old city. Elsewhere, Pope Francis conducted traditional services at the Vatican. And in the Philippines, several villages reenacted the crucifixion of Christ as they have for decades. One man, now 63 years old, was nailed to a cross for the 35th time.
I can't tell for now for how long I can do this, since my body is also getting old. And so I can't say if this will be my last or if I can do it again next year. It will all depend on my body.
Church leaders in the Philippines generally oppose these crucifixions, but the tradition has endured. In Ukraine, Russia launched another wave of aerial attacks overnight. Almost 100 missiles and drones struck power plants at Kyiv and Dniester in a wide-ranging assault across central and western Ukraine. It's the latest in a wave of stepped-up Russian attacks on Ukraine's power system. And a passing of note, Louis Gossett Jr., the first black man to win an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, died today in Santa Monica, California. He debuted on Broadway in 1953 and gained national renown and an Emmy as Fiddler in the 1977 TV miniseries Roots. His Oscar-winning role was as the Marine Corps drill instructor in An Officer and a Gentleman in 1982.
Where you been all your lives? At an orgy? Listening to Mick Jagger music and bad-mouthing your country, I'll bet. You better stop eyeballing me, boy. You're not worthy enough to look your superiors in the eye. Use your peripheral vision. Understand?
Yes, sir.
Now, every time I say understand, I want the whole group to say, yes, sir. Understand?
Yes, sir.
Understand?
Yes, sir.
In later years, Gossett also appeared in the remake of The Color Purple. Louis Gossett Jr. was 87 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Georgia legislature passes new voting rules ahead of the general election. An Oklahoma City Council member faces a recall election for his ties to white nationalism. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. And Beyoncé drops a new genre-defying album.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
When we focus on the ways to reduce America's carbon emissions, we talk a lot about how we generate electricity and the vehicles we use to get around. That's because those two sectors, electricity and transportation, each contribute about a quarter to this country's pollution. And thanks to the rapid growth of renewable energy and more efficient electric cars, those sectors are starting to get much cleaner. But another major source of pollution is what's known as heavy industry. That's making things like cement and steel, and that sector has been much slower to adapt. This week, the Biden administration pledged $6 billion for a series of pilot projects in 20 different states to try and spur a green revolution in those industries. So will this help move the needle? For that, we are joined by Rebecca Dell. She studies how to clean up heavy industry for the Climate Works Foundation. Rebecca Dell, thank you so much for being here. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm says that this is the biggest investment that the United States has ever made in this industry. But it sounds like we haven't really tried to do that much thus far. So I'm just trying to understand, how big an investment is this really?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we talk about the industrial sector, we're talking about manufacturing, construction, all of the activities that make things as opposed to using energy. And so $6 billion is by a very large margin, the largest investment, not just that America has ever made, but that anybody has ever made in cleaning up the greenhouse gas emissions from this sector. But the manufacturing sector in the United States is like a few trillion dollars a year as a set portion of our economy. And so this is a fantastic and inspiring down payment, but obviously this is going to be just a start.
So given that there is this green energy revolution going on right now, why have these slices of the industry been somewhat slow to catch up?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think one of the reasons why we've seen less progress in the industrial sector is just that people only really started working seriously on it in large numbers, maybe about 5 years ago. People have been working on electric vehicles and renewable electricity since the 90s, or depending on how you count it, maybe even since the 70s. And so we're at an earlier stage here. There's also additional complexity that comes because in industrial activity, often the greenhouse gas emissions don't just come from using energy, they also come from the chemical reactions that are happening to make the materials and the products that you want. And so you have to not just swap out clean energy for dirty energy, but often you have to change the nature of the process that you're using. So this is why, those are some of the reasons why it's been a little bit slower in this sector, and why we really need the acceleration that will come from an investment like this one.
So this investment, as I said, is a series of pilot projects that have been awarded to different companies and ventures that applied for these. What kinds of things are getting awarded these grants, and what's it going to look like?
Yeah, so actually one of the things that's so exciting about this project or about this program is that most of the projects are the stage after pilot projects. So most of this are technologies where there's already been a pilot, and this investment is going to take it to actual commercial production scale. And so what we're looking at are things like using hydrogen instead of coal to make steel, using electrified processes to make cement, using alternative types of cement, like, for example, something called limestone and calcined clay cement, LC3, that has inherently lower emissions associated with it. And also there are projects that are using carbon capture and storage. And basically what that means is that you keep using the same process that emits CO2, but instead of letting that CO2 go out into the atmosphere, you capture it and then you pump it into geological formations where it can be stored for a long time.
The Energy Department took great pride that 80% of these projects are going to be ending up in disadvantaged communities that had experienced, quote, years of divestment. What are they referring to there?
Yeah, so I think that's a really exciting part of this. Often the areas around industrial development experience a disproportionately high amount of air and water pollution that harms the local population. Also, as many Americans know, we've had significant deindustrialization in many parts of the United States in recent decades. And so for both of those reasons, DOE really wants to make sure that the communities that host these projects are the communities that were impacted by the health harm and pollution and those job losses. And so those communities really benefit from a healthier environment and the tens of thousands of jobs or more that are going to come from these projects.
All right. Rebecca Dell of the Climate Works Foundation, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This week, the UN said over 1,500 Haitians have been killed so far this year because of a crisis it calls cataclysmic. For nearly a month now, the country has been engulfed in another wave of brutal gang violence. Prime Minister Ariel Henry said he would resign as soon as a transitional council is created that will select a new prime minister. But so far, there has been no breakthrough. Nick Schifrin has this report, and a warning, there are very disturbing images in this story.
This week, parts of Port-au-Prince are a shell of a city. This capital of more than a million is burning. Outgunned police patrol, but the streets are strewn with left-behind garbage and left-behind bodies. There is no protection for the people.
People are just waking up and seeing dead bodies.
American Erica Charles has lived in Haiti for more than a decade. She and her family have been displaced twice from their home near the Port-au-Prince airport.
When they first attacked the airport, that really changed everybody's sense of what do we do now? The places where we thought were safe are no longer safe.
It was 1 month ago today that airport employees ran for their lives after gangs closed the airport, torched police stations, and broke into Haiti's two biggest prisons, releasing more than 4,000 inmates. In a country used to violence, this was different. Designed to bring down the government of unelected Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who assumed power after former President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in 2021.
These last few weeks has taken it to a whole new level, a level that I've never seen in my decade being here. We had to leave our home on March 3rd. The night before we left, we had to move our kids into one room of the house. We slept on the floor so that we could avoid any kind of the possibility of gunfire coming into our home and hurting one of us.
In 9 days, U.S. government-sponsored helicopters have evacuated more than 400 U.S. citizens from Port-au-Prince to neighboring Dominican Republic. And a U.S.-sponsored flight and now commercial planes have departed from the northern Haitian city of Cap-Haitien. In total, 500 U.S. citizens have left. But Charles is the guardian to twin Haitian girls who don't yet have Haitian passports. And even if they did, the U.S. is not yet evacuating Haitian family members of U.S. citizens.
As a mother, I can't I can't leave my kids behind. And so we've been, I've been talking to both Haitian and U.S. Governments to see what options they can offer. And so far, nobody can come up with a solution.
I think that if you can show a familial tie through marriage or birth or whatever, that there should be an exception.
Brian Stern is the founder and CEO of Project Dynamo, a veteran-led nonprofit that evacuates Americans from conflict zones. He urges the U.S. government to expand the categories of people it's evacuating from Haiti.
I think that if you are a green card holder and you're married to an American citizen, you should have an exception.
Project Dynamo received more than 100 rescue requests and this week evacuated 51 American and Canadian citizens out of Port-au-Prince. The group evacuated Americans from Sudan, Afghanistan, and Ukraine. But Stern says evacuating Americans from Haiti through the Dominican Republic has proven especially difficult.
The Dominican Republic, their government has been extremely frustrating as far as getting landing clearance and takeoff clearance and the ability to conduct operations. It means that American citizens are stuck longer surrounded by gangs.
The Dominican Republic has closed its airspace to flights from Haiti and mostly closed the land border to Haitians, despite the humanitarian crisis. Across Haiti, more than 360,000 people are displaced, and 1.4 million Haitians are on the brink of starvation.
Day after day, people are dying because of food, dying because of fear, dying because of stress.
Gary Calixt is with CORE, a humanitarian group helping feed 1,000 families. He says the country is being choked and starved.
The airport is blocked. Some roads are blocked. And the port is also blocked. And you are wondering if after maybe how many days, maybe you might not be able to find what you need as sustenance. People have already invited me to leave the country, but we could have a better Haiti. I would like to live in my country in peace.
But today, there is only war stealing the country's future. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
The death of George Floyd, which sparked a national reckoning over policing, resulted from a police technique that is considered non-lethal. A new investigation led by the Associated Press has now found that is much more common than had been thought. John Yang has our report.
William, the investigation found that between 2012 and 2021, more than 1,000 people died after police used physical force that was not intended to be lethal. That includes batons, stun guns, physical restraints, and chemical agents. The oldest victim they found was 95, the youngest, 15. Only 28 of the officers involved were charged, and the police role was cited in only about half of the cases, meaning that many more Americans have died at the hands of police than previously known. The Associated Press investigation was done with the Howard Center for Investigative Journalism at the University of Maryland and Arizona State University, and PBS's Frontline, whose report on this will air April 30th. AP investigative reporter Reese Dunklin was part of that team. Reese, so how do these use of force that is not intended to be lethal end up in deaths?
Well, we found in hundreds of cases what happened was officers went too far, too fast, too long. And they were making errors in the way they applied this force that went beyond best safety practices. So they would hold people down on the ground, on their chests, in a way where these people couldn't breathe, their hearts couldn't function as properly. And that's exactly what happened to George Floyd. Or in other cases, they would use their stun guns too many times and for too long.
When you look at the victims in these cases, is there a common thread about where these instances happen, who the victims are, and why they were being restrained?
Yeah, we found that in a number of cases, the location was actually the homes of those who died. And that was because sometimes they were having medical emergencies, like potential drug overdoses, and their families were calling 911 to get medical assistance, and the cops arrived, and in order to try to control the person to get medical help, the cops went too far. And another thing we found as far as a commonality is that the toll fell hardest on Black Americans. Even though they represent only 12% of the nation's population, we found that they were about a third of those who died. And probably the last commonality we found was why they were in these situations. And again, it was mental health crises. It was a lot of drugs. And that's what brought them to the attention of law enforcement.
In your report, you say that about half these cases, only about half, is the role of the police cited as either causing or contributing to the death. In the other cases, what do they say? How do they attribute these deaths?
Well, they attribute it in a couple of ways. First, some of these were attributed to a controversial label for a condition that some critics say is a way to justify excessive force. And that label is excited delirium. And that's meant to be a way to say someone is highly agitated, their heart's racing, they're sweating profusely. And police and other people who subscribe to this believe that that in and of itself is life-threatening. So that's how it is used to sort of shift the blame away from the force. In other cases, we found someone's pre-existing medical conditions were blamed, or even their mental health problems. And then in other cases, legitimately, they had very toxic levels of drugs in their system, and that made them vulnerable when police used even just minimal force.
There's been so much focus on police shootings, of course, shooting people who are there trying to stop or trying to arrest. Is there anyone who keeps track of these cases where their non-lethal use of force ends up in a death?
Well, the federal government's supposed to be tracking it through the DOJ, but DOJ has struggled for years to track them in an effective, complete way. DOJ says that's partly because local police departments won't cooperate and send in the information to their states, which can then send it in to the feds. And then CDC tracks it nominally through its mortality death data. But that's not really designed to capture everything, so it doesn't capture everything based on what we found.
It sounds like you'd say that a lot of these are instances where the officer goes too far or just does it in the wrong way. Is this basically a training problem?
That's what some of the experts tell us. You know, many departments and many states get training right. And they have instances like the kind we saw where everyone gets out safe and everyone goes home at the end of the night. But there are departments that aren't following best practices. And the experts told us that if they would just modernize, update, and reassess what policing associations like the International Association of Chiefs of Police prescribe, then maybe we would have fewer deaths.
Reese, you talk about officers going too far or putting the hold on too long. Are there examples you can cite?
Yes. We had one example that we mentioned in the article yesterday where a Texas man was shocked up to 11 times with a taser stun gun, and he was held in what is known as prone restraint. That's pinned down on the ground on your chest where it compresses your lungs so it makes it tough to breathe. He was held that way for 22 minutes. And to give you a frame of reference, George Floyd was held down for roughly 9.5 minutes.
Reese Dunklin of the Associated Press, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Georgia was ground zero for the false claims of election fraud during the 2020 presidential election, and that state was decided by fewer than 12,000 votes. Georgia is in the spotlight again as Joe Biden and Donald Trump head for a rematch. But as Laura Barrón-López explains, new election laws could add additional complications for voters.
In the final hours of the legislative session last night, Georgia Republicans passed a series of new rules that now head to the governor's desk. Among the changes to the state's election laws are making it easier to challenge voter eligibility, expanding access for independent candidates to get on the ballot, expanding use of paper ballots, and restricting who can serve as election workers. Sam Greenglass is a politics reporter for WABE in Atlanta and is here to walk through some of the changes. Sam, thanks so much for joining. Let's start with the new rules to challenge voter eligibility. How do those work?
So this is probably the most prominent change in the legislation passed late last night. And this comes amid efforts by, you know, a handful of individuals to file challenges to the eligibility of thousands of voters at a time. This has proliferated since the 2020 election. And these new rules passed by Georgia Republicans would basically lay out some really specific grounds for sustaining one of these challenges. Things like casting a ballot or claiming a homestead exemption in another state. Republicans say that these are guardrails, basically, to cut down on some of these superfluous challenges. But Democrats insist that these rules will only embolden individuals driven by conspiracy theories who are seeking to toss thousands, if not tens of thousands, of voters off the rolls.
Speaking of those who have been emboldened by conspiracy theories, there have been more than 100,000 challenges to voters in Georgia since the last election law in 2021. Only a few of those have been successful, but what's the real impact of challenges like that?
Well, I think the biggest is that these challenges overburden already overworked election offices. You know, Georgia election law has been changed almost every year since the 2020 election. There are a lot of rules and regulations for election officials to keep up with. And each one of these challenges requires research and an adjudication process that election staff have to deal with. And I think another ramification is that voters feel confused when they see their vote challenged. They have to go through hoops and hurdles to cure that challenge, to make sure that they're able to vote, because again, most of these challenges end up being tossed without probable cause. The Secretary of State already does regular list maintenance, and that captures a lot of the folks who should not be on the roll. So there aren't very many remaining that actually have grounds for removal.
And some Republicans, but mostly Democrats, have been concerned about the effect of third-party candidates this election cycle. What's the change when it comes to third-party candidates, and what do you think the effect will be?
You know, this was kind of a surprise measure that was tacked onto this sweeping bill at the very last minute last night. I was surprised to see it when I was flipping through, I think, the 24 pages of this legislation, you know, probably after 10 p.m. last evening. And, you know, I'm still not sure exactly who slid this in here or what their rationale was for doing it. But I think the big takeaway is that in 2020, the Georgia presidential election was decided by just under 12,000 votes. So when you have a third party on the ballot, that can certainly, you know, play a role in swaying which way the election goes in a really tight race. Now, just one note of caution, this requires a third party candidate to already be on the ballot in, I think, 20 other states. And, you know, the example that we hear the most, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he has not reached that threshold yet.
Conspiracy theories and lies about election fraud have been front and center, especially in a state like Georgia. Do you think that this new piece of legislation will actually quell any concerns there for voters?
You know, I think this is a really important point. You know, since the 2020 election, we've seen several attempts to revise Georgia election law. And in many cases, these moves have been driven by false claims about election fraud in 2020 that have persisted several years on. You know, we heard last night from one Democratic lawmaker who said that this is a bit like negotiating with terrorists, to negotiate with election deniers, people that no matter how many changes you make to Georgia election law, will maybe never really be satisfied as long as these conspiracy theories continue to persist. And it ends up being a bit of a vicious cycle. So I think these next elections will continue to test the staying power of some of these false claims about election fraud that really emerged in the lead up to the 2020 election and are still with us today.
That's Sam Greenglass of WABE in Atlanta. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
In the rural city of Enid, Oklahoma, there will be a recall election next Tuesday over allegations of racism and white supremacy. Commissioner Judd Blevins was confronted at a candidate forum this week by residents who want to oust him for his alleged ties to a white nationalist group. While Blevins has tried to blunt the criticism, it has sharply divided this small town. I spoke recently to NewsHour's community correspondent Adam Kemp, who has been following this closely. So, Adam, let's go back to the start here. Judd Blevins has only been in office for about a year. Was any of his past association known before he was elected?
Yeah, so when he was running for the city commissioner spot, which makes him part of Enid City Council in 2023, the local newspaper there did write a story that detailed some of his relationships with white nationalist groups, including Identity Europa, which is the main group here that he is alleged to have been a part of. It detailed also that he had attended the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. And when confronted by citizens, he had no comment, basically, or wouldn't deny that he was part of one of these groups.
So that was last year. Who started this current recall effort to get him out of office?
Yeah, it's started by the Enid Social Justice Committee, which is just a group of citizens that were concerned about his election. Specifically, I talked to Connie Vickers and Nancy Presnell, who are two members of this group, and lifelong Enid citizens. They confronted Blevins. They held up a giant sign that they had enlarged that allegedly showed him at the rally in Charlottesville holding a tiki torch, and asked him point blank, "Is this you?" And Blevins did not answer their question, and in fact, according to them, ran away from them. I ended up talking to those two women just about confronting Blevins.
If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And you're not name-calling if you call it a duck, and the same with a Nazi.
I was going on Facebook, and I went to a certain Facebook page, and I went under comments. And there I saw this picture, and I was just, petrified that we had a city councilman, a guy running for city council. That had been at Charlottesville. And so I started digging, I posted pictures, Nancy posted pictures, and we just started a campaign against him.
That group ended up collecting nearly 350 signatures to initiate that recall petition.
So has Blevins answered questions about this? Has he said anything more recently about his associations or not?
Yeah, for the longest time, he would neither confirm or deny whether he was a member of these groups or, a white nationalist or believed in white nationalist ideals. But this past week, at a forum held in Enid for the two candidates that are running for the spot, he did confirm that he attended the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, and he gave this reason as why he felt he needed to attend.
Because I felt it was important to protest the removal of statues of American soldiers, of American figures, that if they remove statues of men who fought in the Civil War, they'll move on to whoever they want. Defending, protecting, protesting against the removal of historical Americans is important to me. It's our history, it's our heritage, it's who we are.
Blevins was later then asked to denounce white nationalism, and he responded that he couldn't denounce what he never was.
So if Blevins keeps his seat and the recall fails, what do residents say that this means for their community?
Yeah, talking to residents, they're frankly embarrassed. A lot of them are embarrassed that he was elected in the first place, and now they're pretty petrified that he will be reelected and what that will do to their city's reputation. Beyond that, talking to folks, they're worried about how the city will go about attracting businesses to come do business there in their town, and their ongoing relationship with Vance Air Force Base, which is based there in Enid.
So if someone were to look at this and just say, well, this is just one small city council in Oklahoma, like, what is the larger connection? Is there a larger connection to the white nationalist movement in this country?
Yeah, I talked with Pete Simi, who is an expert on white nationalism in the U.S., started studying it after the Oklahoma City bombing, actually, in 1995. And he said that white nationalists were emboldened after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, and that getting into local elections has been a goal of theirs.
So the danger of having white supremacists holding local office is that this is part of their agenda. in terms of them being able to implement, execute various strategies, various plans as it relates to them wanting to create a white ethno state, for example, which is, obviously a larger plan on the horizon for them. But there's smaller steps along the way that need to happen, and having people hold a local office allow them to potentially achieve some of these smaller steps to the ultimate goal, really, which is, like I said, a white ethno state.
Simi also went on to say that beyond getting into local elections and winning them is the threat of normalizing white supremacy is one of the bigger threats facing this nation.
All right. NewsHour Communities correspondent Adam Kemp, thanks for this great reporting.
Thanks.
Campaign fundraiser nets Biden millions, and a stock market debut could potentially net Trump billions. On that and the other political stories shaping the week, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Gentlemen, so nice to see you.
Thanks for being here.
Let's talk about this money race that is going on. Biden had last night this event in New York City, a Radio City Music Hall, apparently the most lucrative fundraising event in American political history. $25 million, I believe it was. Former presidents out there celebrating him. Does this money matter, especially when you're running against the master of free media, Donald Trump? Does it really matter?
No. Not at all. Those people wasted $25 million. Money matters in politics if you have no name recognition. You want to get known, if you want to have an organization. But once you hit a certain threshold, even in a well-funded Senate race, it doesn't matter. You're just making the rubble bounce. When people are seeing 13, 14 commercials a night, then they're just not noticing. And it's doubly true this time because both Donald Trump and Joe Biden have been president before. Hillary Clinton spent twice as much in 2016 than Donald Trump did, and he still beat her. I think if you think that people who own TV stations don't have enough revenue and you want to put more money into their pockets, then give to a presidential campaign.
Or give to PBS.
PBS.
Do you think it matters?
Yes, it absolutely matters. I mean, David, you're focused on television and campaign ads, but that money is being used to open campaign offices around the country, key districts. It's about hiring staff. State directors, local directors. It's putting, as the campaign would say, boots on the ground to get out the vote. And that is where the money is most needed and most important, especially in a presidential election that is going to be determined by which side gets its people out to vote. And if you are the Biden campaign, you definitely like the position that you're in, having a 2-to-1 cash on hand and fundraising advantage over Donald Trump.
Yeah, it certainly seems like that's something you want as opposed to being at the other end of that ratio.
Political scientists have studied this incredibly. And if you reduce a campaign spending by 50%, the amount of reduction in the actual vote that campaign gets is minuscule. Hmm. So there's just this long-running debate between most political scientists on one hand say money's vastly overrated, most political candidates who are insecure and think if I can get some money, I'll win. But I tend to side with the political scientists, but then I'm all nerd.
Right. I want to ask about this, the Trump Truth Social rocketing on the stock market. What do you make of this, that a company that's the economic fundamentals don't seem that strong, and yet it debuts on the stock market like it is the next greatest thing? How do you view that?
Yeah, its market valuation is 2,000 times revenues. And a lot of companies have market valuations like Reddit or Meta or like 10 times revenues, but this is out of control. And so in my view, it's either people who are, and you're seeing who's investing, it's not hedge fund people, it's individual investors. So I think you've got two groups here. You got one, people who just like Trump and they want to give him money. And two, there are some people who think he'll win the White House, and then Truth Social will be a big, it will actually start making money. But in any case, it looks like a wraparound to give Donald Trump and his campaign a lot of money, which it seems to be doing.
Right. I mean, there are campaign finance restrictions because we don't like the idea of someone just handing a wheelbarrow full of cash to a potential next president. And there are reports here that there's one billionaire investor who's put a lot of money into TikTok, who's now put a lot of money into Donald Trump's new company. Those ethical questions don't go away, though.
They don't. But when you're Donald Trump, do you care? No. you can tell him all, show him all the rules, say, you know, you're pushing that norm, you're violating that rule. And to him, what does he care? He'll push the envelope, he'll do what he wants to do, and then he'll sit back and watch the process play itself out. And while the process plays itself out, he continues to live his life as it was before. So, your next question?
Okay, my next question. I want to talk about what happened with Ronna McDaniel at NBC. For those who are not following this, she was hired by NBC to be an on-air contributor. She's the former chairperson of the Republican National Committee. And there was a revolt amongst many NBC anchors who said, we can't have someone who actively tried to undo the last election be on our payroll and be on our airwaves. What do you make of how that played out?
I was glad they had the instinct to get more Trump-supporting people on the air. I think that's something we all need to work on. But here was someone clearly over the line. Like, to be on our air or in our newspapers, you got to have some intellectual credibility. You have to some primary commitment to the truth, and the truth above partisanship. And she was someone who clearly fails that test. I'm so old-fashioned that our founder here, Jim Lehrer, didn't vote. Like, he just thought, journalists, we don't do that. I don't go as far as Jim did. But I do think there's a difference between being a politico, which is, I admire them, and what we do. We're supposed to represent the truth first and foremost and criticize the parties. And their job is to be partisan. Now, there are people who have gone from being politico to being a journalist. George Stephanopoulos comes to mind, and lots of people. But you got to realize it's a different job with a different set of priorities, a different set of ethics. And to get somebody right off the RNC on the air that as an analyst strikes me as just a gigantic mistake.
I mean, you are an employee of NBC and MSNBC and an anchor on one of the wonderful shows on that network. How did you respond to this?
Well, let's be clear that the Ronna McDaniel hiring was an NBC News hire. I'm at MSNBC. I'm not at NBC News. And when the announcement was made, email came into the inbox. I sent an email from my team. I wrote in response, I want to be clear, she will never be on our show for the exact reasons David talked about. This is not a partisan issue. This was a democracy issue. Every week, Saturday and Sunday, there's at least one block on my show where we talk about either the threats to democracy, how democracy is at risk, the role Trump is playing at putting our democracy at risk. To have someone come on my show where first and foremost, no matter who's watching, my duty is to present the facts. The privilege I have is to be able to say, as an opinion writer and as a prospective host on MSNBC, is I get to say what I think about those facts that I've reported. It would do the show no good, and it would do my viewers no favors, and would be a disservice to put someone on like Ronna McDaniel. And I have to say that our president, Rashida Jones, made it very clear after it was announced, but before there's a story in the Wall Street Journal, made it very clear. You guys have editorial independence. You do not.
You choose if she comes on or not.
Exactly. And that she didn't have to tell me that. I knew that. That's what the leadership is like there. So I agree exactly with what David said. Ronna McDaniel had no business being a paid contributor at NBC.
Yeah, but David, this gets to a point that journalists, a very difficult issue for a lot of journalists, which is how do you represent this slice of the country, the MAGA slice of America, that believe fervently in the things that they believe, but yet it's very difficult to have a conversation with people if you can't even agree on simple facts like who was legitimately elected?
Yeah, this is a problem decades in the making. So when I started as a police reporter in Chicago, there were tons of white working class guys there. I guess in my case, they were tended to be guys, but they had no college degree. It became over the course of the decades that if you wanted to work in journalism, you had to have a college degree. And suddenly we're just slicing off the majority of the country, basically. And so those people felt their voice wasn't heard. And then so there's this populist revolt. And then now you've got a lot of people who are supportive of Donald Trump, but who violate our standards. They don't want to live up to the standards of just basic epistemological modesty or just honesty. We're just going to respect the truth. I do think there are a lot of people out there who would fit both bills, who are good mm-hmm. journalists and support Donald Trump. There's a fine magazine called Compact Magazine that's more populist. There's a place called the Claremont Institute in California that's more populist. I think they're out there. We just have to work harder, I think. I still think we have to work harder to find those people and give them so their voices are heard.
Jonathan, would you have had Ronna McDaniel on as a guest or someone like that as a guest? I mean, I know some of the issue was she's being paid by my organization and she is sort of one of us. But, like, you're open to us as journalists talking to people who challenge the election, et cetera.
Well, one, I'm not going to have someone on my air who's going to try to tell me that 2 + 2 = 5. Like, that is the bare minimum. There's no evidence at all that the 2020 election was stolen from anyone.
Right.
And so if you don't meet that bar, there's no need for me to have you on my show. I'm not interested in having an argument. I'm interested in discussing the issues. I had former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson on my show twice. And I asked him on the air, he was running for president the first time. And I asked him the basic questions. Where are you on the 2020 election? Where are you on this? Where are you on that? And it was my first time asking him those questions, because I figured if you're going to come on my show, you know where I'm coming from. I asked him those questions. He cleared those bars. And then we talked about policy, which in the end is what we're supposed to be talking about.
And you can disagree on policy, and that's part of the process.
Right.
Just in the last minute or so we have left, Joe Lieberman's passing today has brought out all sorts of thoughts and feelings about whether moderates can live in this world and whether they have a future. I know you knew him well. Can you tell us a little bit about your time with him?
My main memory when I learned that he died, there's a tradition in Judaism where the husband is supposed to sing a song called A Woman of Valor to his wife at the Shabbat meal, the Friday night meal. And most of us don't do it because we don't like to hear ourselves sing. But Joe Lieberman would sing it to, I was over at his house a few times, would sing it to his wife, Hadassah. It was so sweet, it was so beautiful, just praising her at the end of each week. He's just a sweet guy.
Do you have any memories you want to share?
Well, I mean, I didn't know the senator well, but I, you know, as a journalist here in Washington, he would come in for ed board meetings, and just an all-around decent person, a person who was in the job for all the right reasons, trying to do the right thing, what was best for the party from his perspective, but also what was best for the country. And when Al Gore, Vice President Gore, chose him to be his vice presidential running mate in 2000, you know, that was a huge moment. That was a huge moment, certainly for him. It was a huge moment for the country because Senator Lieberman was the first Jewish American nominee of any party. And so to me, that will be the senator's legacy.
Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, so nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Willie.
Beyoncé Knowles Carter has just dropped her latest album. It's called Cowboy Carter, and it's quickly becoming one of the most talked about records of the year. Jeffrey Brown has more on how this superstar's new work is deeply rooted in country music.
If it's Beyoncé, it's big. And if it's venturing into an unexpected arena of music, it's even bigger. Cowboy Carter checks both of those boxes and features some of country music's biggest stars. Candace McDuffie covers race, gender, and entertainment for The Root and joins us now. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you know, Beyoncé herself said recently, this ain't a country album, this is a Beyoncé album. But the attention, of course, is because she is going into the country music world. What do you see going on?
Before she released Cowboy Carter, Beyoncé vaguely referenced performing at the 2016 Country Music Awards with the Chicks and how unwelcome she felt in that space. Even though the performance was the highest rated 15-minute segment in the show's history, it was still pulled down from the award show's website, as well as their social media, because people were so outraged that she performed. So here we have this 27-track album. It's very vast, very experimental, almost 80 minutes long, where she reimagines country music, not in a traditional way, but in a Beyoncé kind of way. She puts her own spin on what country music means to her.
Well, so she has said that that past experience caused her to, quote, take a deeper dive into the history of country music. Tell us a little bit more about what you hear, what kind of sounds, what kind of people are included, what has she done?
Well, she pays homage to Linda Martell, the first commercially successful Black woman in country. So Miss Smarty found herself a... She was also the first Black woman to perform at the Grand Ole Opry. So she's introducing certain songs on the record and even talks about genres and how confined they can be for Black artists. Dolly Parton makes an appearance as well. Beyoncé covers Jolene. Jolene, Jolene. And Dolly said back in 2022 she would love for Beyonce to do this, that she would make it as big as Whitney Houston made I Will Always Love You. And we get that on Cowboy Carter.
Well, this does, as you say, play into country music's often difficult history with Black musicians and music, with women musicians often not getting a lot of airplay. What is the thinking about how much impact Beyonce can have?
I mean, she already made history when Texas Hold'em became the first song from a Black woman on the Hot Country Songs chart earlier this year. We already see Black artists having their records streamed more. More people are buying their music because Beyonce gave them that co-sign and that push. And I'm excited to see, especially when it comes to award season, how Cowboy Carter will be recognized.
Beyonce herself, I mean, keeps experimenting, new sounds, new surprises often. Where do you see her going, or where is all this coming from? What drives her?
What drives Beyonce is, I want to say, the element of surprise. Every Beyonce project is very unpredictable. You don't know what you're going to get, but it's going to be a history lesson. And it's very exciting. She keeps music exciting, regardless of the genre. We saw that with Renaissance, where she paid homage to disco music and to house music from a Black female perspective. Now we're seeing that continuation with Cowboy Carter.
And she clearly knows she has the power to get attention.
Absolutely. And I feel like whether it's visual or just the way she uses language, her lyricism, she knows how to captivate her audiences. But it's also really important because she makes everyone feel welcome. Black and brown people feel free when it comes to not only her music, but her shows as well. And then also incorporating the LGBTQ community has been really, really just liberating for all types of people.
All right, Cowboy Carter, it's out today. Candace McDuffie of The Root, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be sure to turn into Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight for a look at the stark contrast between the Biden and Trump campaigns in this year's historic rematch. And on PBS News Weekend, the next in our series, America's Safety Net. What's at stake for millions of Americans on Medicaid as states reevaluate how they offer health insurance? And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm William Brangham. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you so much for joining us.